Today is December 18th. It's a Tuesday. What the heck's going on? This is episode number 493 of the Apple Context Machine. That's a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Brian Chaffin, editor-in-chief of TMO. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, you can shoot us a note at facebook.com/groups/contextmachine. Now, today, my guest is that coughing man, one Peter Cohen. Peter's history in the Mac and Apple space is epic and at least as long as mine. He was the editor-in-chief of Mac Gaming, which is where I started reading him. He then spent many years at Mac Central, which was subsequently purchased by Macworld magazine. From there, The Loop and iMore have both been lucky enough to be graced with his writing, and today he's freelancing wherever the crap he wants to. How's that for cool, ladies and gentlemen, Peter Cohen?
Thank you very much, Brian. Thank you very much for that intro. Hello, everyone.
Indeed, man. It's good to have you here. I really appreciate you stepping into the guest host chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I am very excited about doing this. You built up my intro so much, but I have been using the Mac since I was like 16 years old, you know, and I am a Mac person through and through. So even though I don't actually write about tech too much anymore, I'm still so invested in the space these days.
Did you have to, like, when you went to the store where you bought your Mac, did you have to write a dinosaur? Is that how that works?
Yeah.
Did they have color TV?
They were black and white, man. This was back in the black and white days, Brian. You know, this was a long, long time ago. This was, back when we were still promised jetpacks, I think.
Actually, it was. So what was your first Mac?
My first Mac was steam powered. No, just kidding. My first Mac was a Fat Mac. Remember the Fat Mac?
Yeah, of course. No. I was not cool enough or wealthy enough to have a Mac back in the day. I know about the Fat Mac. I've studied the Fat Mac. I certainly remember all about the Fat Mac, but not because I was there. So I don't want to. No, I'm not going to put on any airs here.
Yeah.
My first Mac to own was a Power Computing Power 100.
Those things were so cool.
They were. Well, that was the cheap one. That was the intro level.
Yeah, but all of them were cool, because they were actually within reach of normal people who couldn't afford the premium hardware that Apple was selling.
Did I ever tell you the story of getting the G3 prototype from them?
No.
So you remember Mike Rosenfeld?
Sure.
So he was the marketing director or VP or whatever at Power Computing.
At Power, right, yeah.
Great guy. Like him. This was like in the final days of Power Computing's existence. They had developed the G3. Apple wouldn't let them sell it for a variety of reasons, actually a whole lot of it. Like Apple was basically using an artificial name change of macOS, 7.8 to 8, right?
Right.
To pull 7.6
to 7.6 to 8, right?
Well, it was... I was beta testing in it, and it was 7.8.
Okay.
It was still called 7.8. And then Steve came up with the idea of changing the name to Mac OS 8, or the lawyers came up with this idea, because all the clone makers were only licensed for Mac OS 7.X.
Right.
It was genius. A genius solution to end the cloning program. So anyway, Power Computing had developed this G3 prototype. Mm-hmm. And Mike let me take one home to test for a couple of days. And he wasn't supposed to do it. I don't think he was supposed to do it. He said he wasn't supposed to do it. And judging by the reaction when I returned it, he wasn't supposed to do it. And so I tested it, and it was just like blazing fast. And oh my God, this thing is incredibly cool. And here's the thing, Peter, I took it back as foreshadowed. I should not have taken it back because Mike quit during the days, or was fired, you know, tomato, tomato, possibly. But he quit, and he quit. He wanted Power Computing to fight the change, and Power Computing wasn't. At least this is what he said. And he quit while I still had it in my possession. So I call him up And I say, hey, can I keep it for another day? But I couldn't get a hold of him. That was what I was going to ask. And so I was like, I promised to have this back on Tuesday. I promised to have it back on Tuesday. I'm going to have it back on Tuesday. So I drove up to Round Rock. I was in Austin at this time. I drove up to Round Rock to drop it off. I'm like, you know, walking into the front door. And it's like, hey, is Mike there? And they're like, no, because he had quit. I didn't know that. And I said, well, I've got this Power Mac G3 that, or this Power Tower G3 that I was supposed to return, and I like sort of get these wide eyes and you know, accept it back. And then I found out that, like, if he had just told me he'd quit, I would have been able to keep it.
That's right. So this is the one that got away because you threw it back.
Yes. Yes. Now I also ended up getting the Motorola G3 prototype, and that one, and I did end up keeping.
Very good.
That one was kind of a mess. That one was kind of a mess, to be honest.
Oh,
so anyway, that's my power computing story.
It was, I mean, it was an interesting time at Apple too, because they were going from old world to new world architecture, and of course, everything that came after that was Apple's biggest successes continuously. So it was really kind of the start of something amazing, even though there was that destruction of that that cottage industry that had popped up through that period.
Yeah, and here's another fun confession. Do you remember you remember my Apple Death Knell counter, right?
Yes.
Yeah, there was I wrote a column saying that, you know, Steve could go back to Next or leave Apple or something because he'd done enough of saving Apple, because I was all pissy about the clone program. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oops.
Hey, look. I mean, well, look, you know, if you're not, if you look, you and I have known each other a long time in this business, brother. I think that we've all had those moments of the poison pen where we just had to say what was on our minds and, you know, justified or not, or aligned with reality or not, whatever, you have to speak your own truth sometimes.
Yeah, and I seldom mind admitting that I was wrong.
Sure.
Because I was pissy about CyberDoc being killed, OpenDoc being killed, CyberDog being killed. I was pissy about the clone program. And Steve was right to kill all that stuff. He was right. He was absolutely right.
I don't know. I still think OpenDoc could have been something.
OpenDoc could have been something, but the question is whether or not it could have been something with the resources that Apple had at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's the, I don't think it's, when I say that he was right to kill it, it's not because of a technology thing. It's just because of a resource thing. He knew that Apple needed to get back and focus on doing just a few things and doing them well.
Yeah. At that time it was imperative because the company was out of money, out of ideas. Their stuff was hot garbage and they were getting their asses beat everywhere they turned.
Yes. Yes.
You know?
Yes, indeed. All right. So believe it or not though, that's not our first topic. Our first topic today is sort of an umbrella thing. It's Apple Cloud Services. And I know that this has been on your mind lately from some problems that you had been running into.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, my friend Rene Ritchie over at iMore, our friend Rene Ritchie over at iMore, I should say, likes to talk about the balance between security and convenience that Apple tries to maintain in their products. And I think that there's a lot of truth to what he says about that. I think on their surface, Touch ID and Face ID and all of these technologies that make it easier for us to interact with our products are good, useful things. But when they don't work right, when things break down somewhere in the chain and you've got a person who needs to reset their device, or a person who's forgotten their passcode even, and this happens a lot, there's a fundamental disconnect in that user experience where Apple, I think, in order to guard its users' privacy, is not making it easy for those same users to kind of reconnect with their information.
Yeah.
I hope I'm not getting esoteric on this, but no. I think that this is a fundamental problem that's actually afflicting a lot more of the population than a lot of people who talk about this stuff and write about this stuff and think about this stuff, and for that matter, make this stuff, really invest a lot of time in thinking about. You know, I'm talking about old people. I'm talking about busy moms and dads who have to take time out of the week to unlock their kids' devices. I'm talking about a fairly significant part of the population of people for whom these devices are just black boxes, a means to an end to get something done. And when it doesn't work, it creates not just a problem getting their stuff in the cloud. It creates an existential dilemma for them. You know, because so much of our lives are lived on these devices now.
Yeah. So there are a couple of questions. There's three questions for this for me, because this certainly has been something that's been on my mind for, you know, off and on for a long time. Here's the first question is this.
Right.
Why does Apple have so many problems in this area? That's the first question. The second question is, can Apple ever fix it? Is this something that Apple can ever do as right as we think that it should be? And I had a third question and it's gone. But those two questions are the two most important. Why is this such a problem for Apple?
Damned if I know. But it has been ever since iTools was the thing. You know, or eWorld. You know.
Did you use eWorld?
Yeah, reluctantly.
Did it work?
Yeah, it was all right. It was just a skin for AOL. You know, essentially.
Yeah, but did it work?
Yeah, it did.
So then why are you lumping that in?
Why am I lumping it in?
Yeah, why are you lumping it in as, like, you know, like, since eWorld this has been a problem?
Because it failed.
Well, it failed from a business standpoint. Did it fail from a technology standpoint? It wasn't killed. That's not even something that Steve killed. It was killed before. Right? Did Steve kill eWorld?
I can't remember.
Let's see.
And I'm too lazy to look it up right now.
Well, we have software making equipment right here. Apple kills eWorld. How Apple killed innovation. No, that's not what we want.
Oh, yeah, Apple killed innovation. Oh, okay. Well, that, I'm sure that's an interesting topic, but not for our discussion today.
Let the Forbes be, so, you know, whatevs. eWorld. Why can I not find eWorld?
Your Google foo is weak.
Apparently it is. So anyway, my point is that it wasn't killed for a technology reason. It was killed for business reasons. And what we're talking about right now is essentially a technology fail, or at the very least, a technology not, you know, it doesn't just work.
Ping. iTunes Connect. That's the latest failure to understand how people interact on social networks.
Well, okay, well, now... Are we talking social networks or cloud services?
Aren't they the same thing?
No, they're not. Like iTunes, like syncing is not any issues with syncing is not the same kind of problems for how people interact on social networks.
I think it demonstrates a larger incompetency to understand how cloud technology is integrated into our lives.
No, I don't think so. The social networking stuff, which Apple has been a failure at, unfortunately, that's not related to technology. That's related to people and connections, which, you know, unfortunately, Facebook understands and uses to our detriment. But that's what's happening.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with you. But anyway, why does Apple have problems with cloud services? Apple has expanded its cloud service footprint dramatically, right? And I mean, it's interesting because services, so all that stuff that's under that umbrella of This is how people interact with our devices, and this is how we make money off that, has been a growing segment of their revenue for years now. So clearly they're invested in it as a business project that is giving them money, right? It's a success for them. They're growing it. That's why I don't understand why they make it so hard for people to do this. And also, for that matter, why Apple is so parsimonious with storage space for iCloud.
that is indeed a related question. Okay, but at the same time, one of the things that Apple does pretty well is app syncing. Like the stuff with the App Store works pretty well. Getting your songs and before Apple Music, at least before what was the service before Apple Music for like putting your music in the cloud, which was obviously problematic.
iTunes Cloud Music or whatever it was.
Yeah,
that separate like that. Service.
Yeah,
right.
Yes. And I apologize, by the way, we're having a little bit of a connectivity issue every once in a while, folks. If I can't understand Peter, I will stop the recording and we'll fix that. But if you're hearing any pixelation in his voice, my apologies. So the iTunes Cloud Music, I think is what it was called, that was kind of problematic. But before that, you know, you buy your music on the iTunes, you can put it on any device that you want, you're good to go. That worked really, really well. iBooks, or Apple Books as it's now called, works really well. So, you know, and those are things that, like, they work so well that we don't think about them, and then we end up not giving Apple any credit for them, too.
I'll agree with that. Absolutely. When the stuff works, it's magic.
Yeah. But
when it doesn't, it becomes madly intrusive.
Yeah. And recently, for instance, I've been experiencing a lot of problems with having my contacts synced and getting them synced between devices. And I ended up losing like 3 years worth of several years, actually, worth of contacts. Ended up getting them back because I had them on another machine that hadn't been opened, like my old MacBook Air hadn't been opened, but ended up, like, it turned out that I had some contacts being stored on through Google, which I had never intended, and I also had some contacts being stored on my Mac, which I also hadn't intended. And even though those are in some ways user error, my error, at the same time, it is related to the syncing stuff, and it should have been really easy to figure that out. Or better yet, it should have been really easy not to make the mistakes that I made. And those are things. And it ended up taking a level two tier two or tier three support person to actually help me figure it out the first time, and then it ended up taking Dave Hamilton to help me figure out the rest of it. So, you know, that's like a tier 52 or something like that. So. So my point is that, and I've had, and like, you know, I can't tell you how many of my friends have said that my iMessages aren't syncing up. I'm assuming you've experienced that.
I've certainly experienced that. My favorite thing is when iMessage groups split and or threads split. And so you'll have like multiple threads going that actually have the exact same participants in them. That drives me nuts.
That is crazy. Yes. That should not happen.
No, that shouldn't happen. It's just ugly and dumb, you know? You know, there are so many little bits and pieces of this, overall that just, it sounds like we're nitpicking, but really here's the thing. You're expecting a level of frictionless interaction with your data when you're using Apple products.
I think
that's really kind of, that's what we're paying for. That's conceptually what they're trying to do. I was helping this elderly woman with her problem with her Mac. For some reason, her contacts had disappeared. Now she had the stuff synced in iCloud, but iCloud wasn't pushing down to her Mac worth for nothing. You know, we ended up blasting her local library. I figured out that, well, I don't know. How I got it working again was blasting her local library. I had already opened it up in iCloud.com so I could see that she had a backup of her stuff down in there. But it actually took deleting that local address book database.
On
and
iCloud?
Telling, no, on the Mac.
Oh, okay.
And then telling iCloud, push out the last backup of this contact database to all your devices that are synced, before it would start talking again. That's not something that a user is going to be able to figure out on their own if they don't have an IT background. That's not an easy thing for somebody who's just a Mac user to understand.
It's not. Listen, it's something I consider myself, I don't know, I'm maybe not as expert as I think, but I am certainly close to expert. I certainly know more than your average bear, and I have trouble with that stuff. So yeah. To your point, I mean, I absolutely agree. And it's, again, it's the sort of thing that it's what we're paying for is it, we want it to just work. So the question then comes back to, again, why does Apple actually have trouble with this stuff? For instance, why can the App Store be so frictionless, so seamless when these other things don't work? Or don't work as well as they should.
Yeah, it's a question for the ages. I think it's just a matter of them not prioritizing that in the same way.
Mm-hmm. I think you're probably
right. And maybe the numbers are on their side, right? Maybe these issues are so fringe for the vast majority of their customers, they figure it's worth the friction. But
I hope that I would like to think that that's not the case. I would like to think that a decision hasn't been made by Bean Counter somewhere saying that, well, you know, as long as only X percentage of our users have this problem, we're not going to bother solving it. I hope that's not the case. It could be. We don't have any evidence one way or the other, but it could be the case.
Well, we've seen Apple kind of force attrition before, too. You know, we've seen it just conceptually in the way that they market, sell, and support these products now. You know, you and I both remember a time when you would buy a Mac and you would use that Mac basically into the ground. This created a problem for Apple, right? People were buying Macs and were intensely loyal to them, but they weren't exactly turning over their equipment every year. You know, nowadays, if you walk into an Apple store and buy a brand new computer, you can expect to get parts for it in the rest of the United States, not in California, but in the rest of the United States for about 6 years before, maybe seven, if you're lucky, before Apple declares that it's a quote unquote vintage product and pulls those parts out of circulation. Now, if you're in California, you can actually get parts for up to 10 years. And if you live in Turkey, too, the country of Turkey, they also cover that. But outside of those two countries, yes, the country of California, the country of Turkey.
That's about right, by the way.
Once these parts are declared vintage, you can't get them from Apple authorized service providers or from Apple stores anymore, or from Apple, like Apple repair depots don't even get those parts anymore. So they effectively push those older devices out of service just by attrition. They also stopped supporting them with new updates. Mojave came out this year, and Mojave won't work on any machine that was built before 2012.
Okay, while true, all that is true. My experience is that that's better than the PC world. Can you put the latest version of Windows 10 on a 6 or 7 year old PC?
I have no idea. That's not my world. Like I said at the outset, I'm a Mac guy through and through.
Yeah, I personally am in the camp that supporting a device for 6 or 7 years is actually pretty darn good.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's interesting how these things stop working over time. You know, it's interesting how, yeah, I can give you a practical example of where there was a legitimate breakdown in Apple's quality control for supporting those legacy customers. And this happened just last week.
Okay.
Last Thursday, people started complaining when Safari, they would open Safari and they would get a very strange message on their screen that was actually, you know, legitimate system crash message, but so generic you would never know that this was legitimate. If you were just a regular muggle who didn't really know a lot about the way that these computers worked, saying Safari's crashed and you should contact the developer because it looks like this app might need an update or something, and then a whole bunch of text information. You've seen these messages a thousand mm-hmm. times. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So is every person who's listening to us right now. Mm-hmm. For the average user, that's a very unsettling experience, especially when it's an app you use every day, multiple times a day, like Safari. Really kind of scary. And nothing that they could do would make it work again. Even if they, you know, checked updates, if they knew that much, they wouldn't find anything that would help them. Fast forward to Monday, Apple actually did fix it, and the way that they fixed it was by pushing out an iTunes update. What had happened is that the previous version of iTunes that they had pushed out came with a mobile devices framework file in the root directory of the system on that Mac that did not work right. And it, for whatever reason, for whatever problem it had, it was causing Safari issues. Now, here's the interesting thing about that framework, just as a matter of background. It is used by iTunes to sync devices that are running iOS via USB. So if you tether your iPhone or your iPad to your Macintosh to sync it with iTunes or to back it up or do anything like that, this particular framework file gets invoked and the information in it lets your Mac manage that connection. For whatever reason, iTunes, the previous version, had damaged it. Now, this only happens, it turns out, on Yosemite systems running 10.10.5. Now, Yosemite is an operating system that, quite frankly, I haven't given much thought about, you know, in 4 years. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of machines out there still running Yosemite because the path of least resistance for those users is to stick with, you know, is to dance with the one that brung you,
yeah,
as they used to say.
Yeah.
You know, is to use the stuff that was on the machine. They don't run updates. Apple doesn't push updates out to machines of that era. And opt-in for automatic updates is a fairly recent phenomenon.
Right.
In Mac OS. So it was this lingering edge case where a whole bunch of users, you know, were affected by it, but it was really just kind of a careless oversight of QA that, you know, maybe Apple should have been able to see through if their testing recursions had been, you know, thorough enough.
So why?
We're always going to be afflicted by bugs. We're always going to be afflicted by bugs. We accept that as a given, don't we?
I do. I think it is reasonable. I believe that reality dictates that we accept the premise that software will not be perfect and probably cannot be perfect, at least as we understand software development now.
Yeah, I completely agree with that.
There could certainly become a day where machine learning processes or even AI processes especially once we have quantum computing, could actually run through every possible permutation. But until that day, actually, that day will probably come at some point. It's just a matter of how quickly. So really, the only issue there is, but we're not there now. We're not going to be there anywhere near. So yeah, we have to accept that software is not going to be perfect. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't hold software companies to a high standard, and it doesn't mean that we shouldn't demand excellence, and it also doesn't mean that we should be okay about catastrophic problems.
I completely agree with everything that you just said. I think that we as customers need to hold Apple to the high standards that they themselves espouse.
Yes, especially because they're espousing them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so I do end up having a hard out today, so I want to get to our other topics.
Go for it.
Topic two, password management. Now, I happen to know this is something that is near and dear to both of our hearts.
Damn, man. You know, if you're going to – here's like password management like 101 for me. If you are going to keep a text file of your passwords to everything in your life, mm-hmm. that's cool. I understand why you want to do that. Don't put it on the device that has the passwords that you're storing in that text file.
Correct. Do not. I'm laughing because I've done it, and I do not do it anymore, but I have done it, and it is, I mean, you know, it's the digital equivalent of putting the password to your computer on a sticky note on your computer.
Except kind of the inverse.
It is, yeah. fair enough. It's the inverse of that. But, yeah, you don't... Let's cut to the chase.
Yeah.
Let's cut to the chase. First of all, I believe in using password managers.
I do, too.
I use 1Password.
Mm-hmm.
Do you use 1Password?
I will only admit to using iCloud Keychain.
You will only admit to it?
Yes.
Explain that.
I'm not going to reveal anything about my
that's much smarter than me.
Password management profile.
That's much smarter than me, except for the fact that I absolutely and positively endorse 1Password. And I'm not being paid to endorse 1Password.
I have my list of companies that I am very happy to endorse as well. But for the purposes of our conversation, I'll tell you about my iCloud Keychain experience, because in that respect, you're talking about the seamlessness of the App Store. I found it to be pretty bulletproof.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, that's true, and it's something that Apple doesn't get enough credit for,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, we focus on the things that don't work, and then you know, and we forget about the things that do work. And iCloud Keychain is, believe me, right now there are untold numbers of parties hammering on iCloud Keychain trying to bust it. Right now, as we speak, as we're recording this, every day of the year, someone is trying to crack, break into, bypass iCloud Keychain and get our passwords that are stored that way.
And I don't think that you, I think you understate it too, because you say someone as if implying that just, you know, one or two people are doing it. We're talking about thousands, if not millions, of intrusion attempts a day.
Yeah. Chinese government, Russian government, organized crime, the NSA, possibly the CIA, the Turkish government, the German government, the British government, all of the governments.
The Sasquatches, the Greys, too, and the reptilians.
Well, they've already cracked it.
Yes,
but
it's true.
But I mean,
privacy is a myth, people. We're all part of the Matrix.
Government security apparatuses, government security institutions all over the world are trying to crack it as a matter of routine. Organized crime is trying to crack it as a matter of routine. White hat hackers are trying to crack it. Black hat hackers. Oh my God! If you could crack. iCloud Keychain, you could probably sell the secrets of that for possibly billions.
But Brian, what about the time that people hacked nudie photos off of iCloud? Don't you remember?
I do remember that. And of course, I know that you're setting me up, so I will oblige. The iCloud was not hacked. People's crappy passwords were guessed at. And
hey, in fairness, I mean, just on a pedantic level, social engineering is one of the finest forms of hackery.
Yes, this is true. Yeah. And you can't software your way out of social engineering.
That's exactly right. As long as human beings are involved, social engineering, you know, can be manipulated. Gee, look at Facebook.
Yes. Absolutely and positively. So I endorse, I do use 1Password. I respect the fact that you won't tell us what you use. As a matter of fact, I think that's way smarter than me telling anybody. I believe in using long, complex, and unique passwords everywhere you go. And I believe in them being passwords that you could never possibly remember because you've got 1,000 of them. Like every single password you use should be unique. And the only real way to do that in a secure fashion is to use a trusted password manager.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you endorse? And are you paid to endorse them?
Like I said, I use iCloud Keychain for everything. And it produces strong passwords. I love the way that it integrates on the device, and I'm very happy with it. So I use that. And you know what? I also have an actual book that I keep in a drawer with my basically all the passwords of note actually written down.
What's your address again? Why don't you at least have that in a safe or in a safety deposit box?
Maybe I do.
Well, you also said, okay, why don't you exclusively have it in a safe or in a safety deposit box?
Well, because I have to update it quite frequently.
Huh. So here's another, I know that the long time listeners in the show will have heard the story.
And why? Because I'm not worried about somebody breaking into my house and stealing my password book. In fact, I want it in plain sight. It's for the safety and security of me and my family to have it like that in the event that I'm incapacitated, for example, and my wife would need, you know, access, or one of my kids would need access to my accounts, you know, to be able to update them or take stewardship of them or what have you.
You can still do that with a safe or a safety deposit box.
So but like I said, I'm updating this all the time, so I don't have to take it off site.
All right, fair enough. Although I would argue that one could have two passwords. You could have your system password, and you could have 3 passwords: your iTunes password, your system password, and your password manager password. And you could have those sitting in the software, sitting in the safety deposit box, and boom.
Sure, and you know, it depends on how precious you want to get, right?
That's true. So let me tell you my little anecdotal tangent here, talking about like the hassle of going to the bank all the time. When I got my Power 100 from Power Computing, it came with a copy of macOS 7.6 for Dummies by Bob Levitas. Right?
I know that guy.
Of course you do. And his section of I love Bob. I love Bob so much. So Bob has a chapter on backups, and like his recommended routine at that time was you have a daily backup for every day on floppy disks. This was 1995, right? So you have a daily backup every day on floppy disks, and you keep, you know, the 7-day rotating collection of floppy disks with your daily backups. Then you have a weekly backup that you take to the bank on floppy disks, and you put them in your safety deposit box, where you also have a monthly backup in your safety deposit box.
And so basically he built a physical version of Time Machine.
Yes, where he's using the sneaker net or the driving net to
make snapshots. That's incredible. That's amazing. Dude, like he was so cutting edge. Holy crap. That's amazing. Levitas, you rock star.
It is not something most normal people. Now he of course recommends using a variety of online storage, Time Machine and a local backup and a local copy and using an encrypted online storage. So you're not actually driving this stuff on floppy disks. Oh my God. To the bank every week. But
Well, I think it's a real good idea to combine local backup, like local storage with cloud storage. You know, yes. And making that as easy to use as you can. And that's why I've become so dependent on iCloud over the years.
as long as you hold the keys.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, it's like I keep a time machine backup, you know, because I think time machine is important. And I like the fact that I have a local backup that I can restore from. Mm-hmm. Makes it dead easy, too, when I get a new computer. Mm-hmm. You know, you just plug it in. Second question that your Mac asks you is, do you have a time machine backup to restore from? You plug it in and blam, you're right back, you know, off to the races from mm-hmm. where you left. That part is great. The ability to pull files that you might have deleted and, you know, other stuff from past snapshots is terrific too. So I love having a local time machine backup, and I think it should be a really important regimen for people who are storing data on their computers that's important, but augment it with some kind of offsite backup, you know, in other words, something in the cloud. And, you know, again, I'm very impressed, you know, for the most part, how iCloud works. It's just that when it doesn't, it gets really scary.
Right. All right. So give us your recommended password regimen for people to follow.
Use strong passwords. Use passwords that you have no idea what they are. Do it with a password manager. Find a password manager that you like. You don't need my recommendations for it. Just do the research. Look for Mac password managers. LastPass.
That's such a cop-out, man. Come on, dude. I get that you don't want to say anything, but if you're doing your research, it's because someone has said something. So I will say that LastPass, if you want something where it's stored in the cloud, and I prefer 1Password because you keep the keys.
Keeping the keys is important.
Yes.
Yeah, this is one of the interesting places where iCloud.password can kind of break down, too. When you have to reauthorize these devices, when they're reconnecting to the cloud, a lot of people have input a passcode that they can't remember. Yeah. I've come across this so many times. And again, it's another layer where Apple is adding a layer of security to make sure that you are who you are. And they err on the side of that every time. It's easy to exclude what's actually on the other end of that, which is often a really frustrated person who is just trying to reconnect to their device, instead of a nefarious person who's stolen an iPhone, or somebody who's actually trying to intrude into somebody else's iCloud account.
Right.
Or Apple ID account. That part is very frustrating, and that part is an area of friction where I think Apple can and should do better.
Well, so is there a move towards, you know, Touch ID and or Face ID? Is that not part of that?
That's part of the convenience aspect of it. This makes it easier for me to unlock my device and verify that I am who I am. But it also doesn't always work. Or there are circumstances where that's not helpful because I've broken the screen on my device. So all of a sudden the camera's not working,
right?
You know, but I still need to access the data on it, or I need to restore it now that it's been fixed.
Right.
And it's not a simple experience for those folks.
Nope. It's not. And this is another area where I think that because there is no, there is always tension between, and this is something that Dave Hamilton has pointed out a lot. There's always tension between security and convenience.
Yeah, yeah.
The more secure it is, the less convenient it is. And the more convenient it is, the less secure it is.
Yep.
And so far, this is inescapable. We don't know that it'll always be inescapable. We don't know that if there could someday be something that is perfectly secure and perfectly convenient. But I kind of doubt we'll get to that day. So
it'll be owned by Disney, whatever it is.
It's that tension is always going to go back and forth a little bit, and I think that we have to accept there will always be situations, edge cases, and scenarios where the user is essentially screwed. We can't protect against every little thing, but you, the user, can do your utmost to be as secure as possible. And that includes, in my opinion, using a password manager.
Agreed.
All right, rock on. So let's see here. Our third topic. We've got 10 minutes, Peter. 10 minutes before I've got my heart out. Apple leadership.
Heart out, people. God, get your minds out of the gutter.
Apple leadership. The best or simply better than everyone else? Discuss.
I'm kidding. You know, there's so much mad talent. Come on.
Well, you know, it's interesting too, right? You look at, like, when people leave Apple, there are very few success stories.
Yeah, Ron Johnson had a hard fall from grace after he left Apple, you know, creating Apple's retail presence and then just having a disastrous experience trying to run JCPenney as an actual modern department store.
Well, okay, I got to defend Ron Johnson because I think that Ron Johnson is probably one of those Apple success stories that could have been a success story when he left Apple if the board of directors wasn't such chicken blank. And because they were not willing to go through the, like, all the stuff he was doing at JCPenney was really interesting. And if the board of directors at JCPenney hadn't freaked out so much about the transition pain and let him continue, I think that JCPenney today would be a stronger, viable operation and be an interesting, upscale, interesting place to shop.
Yeah, they'd be doing as well as Sears, I'm sure.
No, I think they'd be doing well. I think that Ron Johnson's failure at JCPenney was about the JCPenney board and not Ron Johnson. I think he did a great job when he was there.
I think he misjudged the customer culture that JCPenney had created. I think he intentionally disrupted it, but didn't understand how damaging it was going to be to their bottom line.
Do you mean that you think that he tried, like, he went in, he tried to upgrade JCPenney too much? Is that essentially what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah, he had a vision of JCPenney that their consumer was not interested in.
Or he had a vision of what he wanted to do, and he found the wrong company to let him do it.
Yeah, maybe that was the case.
I will
incontrovertibly though, Brian, Ron Johnson did not lead JCPenney successfully at the end of the day. Whether you think he did a good job or didn't do a good job, the result wasn't seen in the balance sheets, and that's why he left. That's why he was out the door.
He didn't leave. He was fired. But
that's what I meant. I was trying to be kind.
But I think if he had been given enough time, the bottom line would have come around. I think that if he'd been given enough time, that JCPenney would have become the kind of shopping place that can survive in a world ruled by Amazon.
And, you know, the interesting thing is that Apple's retail group really didn't thrive after Johnson left either, at least until Angela Ahrens took over.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of it was because it was leaderless for a while, and then it had, like Tim Cook's worst hiring mistake, John Brower.
Right.
I don't even know what he was thinking.
Yeah.
That's Tim Cook's biggest mistake.
It's Tim Cook's G4 cube.
Yeah, maybe. All right. Well, so one of the things that I always think about when I start thinking about Apple's leadership is I think about the leadership team. And I think about the fact that the leadership team that Steve Jobs put together is still largely there. It's a little larger now, but there have been very few people who have left. Scott Forstall being the obvious exception, and then Ron Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of those people have stuck around. And I find that, like, comforting and interesting, and at the same time, sometimes even baffling. Because, like, at first, the first few years after Steve Jobs died, I thought to myself, okay, all of these people have just committed to making sure that Apple can survive Steve's passing. But now we're clearly well beyond that, and they still stick around. They're all wealthy as can possibly be. And they all, like, you know, they could all go and fail somewhere else like everybody else has if they wanted to. I mean, like, what keeps them at Apple? I mean, it's like it's clearly not love of the Mac, because the Mac gets very little love anymore. I don't even think it's love of iPhone. So what keeps them at Apple?
Well, conceptually, I mean, look, an opportunity to run one of the most important and influential companies, period, not just tech companies, you know, is a very rare privilege that only a few people are ever going to experience. So it makes sense that there would be a lot of,
but it's the personality. Steve Jobs built that team, and he built that team with all of its various, you know, frictions and tensions, and they all answered to Steve in a particular kind of way. And Tim Cook is a different CEO. He's a different manager. He has a different managing style. Apple clearly has different goals now. The moonshot products that they're working on, to me, seem to be the thing that is really, really taking their time and attention. It's you seldom have a new CEO maintain the same leadership circle as his predecessor. You just don't see that. I mean, and Tim Cook should probably be getting lots of credit for that he does not get from anybody. And it's an interesting thing to me.
It's also interesting how he's really pivoted the company to have a very clear moral position on a lot of what it's doing and a lot of what it's seeing in the world and in politics. And in that respect, I think Apple's been a lot more activist as an organization of their size than a lot of other businesses in the tech space and out of the tech space as well. Right? Apple has a very clear moral message to its users, and it's not afraid also to put its money where its mouth is when it comes to issues of social justice and welfare. I think that's been a very interesting differentiator for Apple under Tim Cook than it was under Steve Jobs. There was certainly a lot of like peace and love and hippie stuff projected as a marketing message,
but it was all in service of the product.
But it was all in the service of the product. That is different. I think that one thing that Tim Cook probably doesn't get nearly enough recognition for is really kind of imbuing Apple with, I guess for lack of a better term, a soul that it didn't necessarily have before.
I would, and just in case anybody had trouble understanding that, Peter just said that he thinks that Tim Cook imbued Apple with a soul that it didn't have before, but I'm going to twist that, Peter.
Okay, good.
I'm going to twist that and say that he imbued Apple with a different soul, because it used to absolutely be that in service of the product was Apple's soul. Mm-hmm. And I know people who don't like the fact that that's no longer Apple's. That Apple has any position on anything whatsoever, and that's fine. People are welcome to think what they want and to want what they want, et cetera. But I think that Apple had a soul. I think that Apple was probably floundering without Steve. The years before Steve came back, that Apple's soul was essentially lacking leadership. Steve came back, he reinvigorated that soulful leadership, but it was different than Tim's. So I don't think that Apple didn't have a soul before Tim. I think that it's just different now.
Yeah, okay. I agree with all that. And I'm walking back what I just said too. The way that you explained it, I think is very smart. But I do think that soul has changed irrevocably, and I think that one of the big things that's come out of it, because it's evolved over time, and our use of the technology has evolved over time. One thing that Apple very clearly differentiates today. And this has created friction between it and Facebook and it and the U.S. government, is that the soul of the product, the soul of the experience is ultimately the user and the safety and security of the user.
Yes.
You know, and that's that, I think, especially when your products, your hardware products and your services are so intertwined. I think that's crucial. And I think it's strongly in service of Apple to continue to hone that message and embrace that philosophy in every aspect of what they're doing, because it's so incredibly important.
It is. It is. And Apple's leadership in particular in the world of the environment, I think, has been here's the thing I think it's important about that, Peter. Apple is showing that a profitable company can not have a detrimental impact on the environment. And I think that runs contrary to the typical view, not only here in the United States, but elsewhere in the world, where the environment is always costly, that it's going to detract from your profits. And it's going to be a problem, and that, you know, it's something that you do that's burdensome to do. And Apple is showing that doesn't have to be the case.
Apple's also transparent about it in a way that very few companies are still today.
Well, yeah, but how much of that is because Apple's doing something that it wants to be transparent about? But the other companies aren't transparent about it because they're not doing those things.
That's exactly my point.
Yeah, but so if Apple wasn't doing those things, it wouldn't be transparent about it.
Right, exactly.
Okay, all right. All right, man, dude, this was I really, really, really appreciate
marketing!
You. I really appreciate you stepping into guest host today.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me. It was great rapping with you, man. And I apologize for the technical issues.
I think that they're probably on my end, so I apologize for the technical issues, and I apologize to our listeners. Hopefully, I will be able to edit that stuff out, and everything will be seamless, and they'll be going, huh, what are they talking about? The show was great. So we'll see.
There we go.
We'll see. All right. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to do a bumper. And then I'm going to speak, and then I'm going to do another bumper. But I'm essentially going to end up saying goodbye to you at some point during that okay. process. So here we go. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, you can write us at acm@macobserver.com. Head over to Facebook if you want, facebook.com/groups/contextmachine. Peter, by the way, groups is the one thing I like about Facebook.
Yeah, just, absolutely.
It's like I bag on Facebook all the time. It's a thing. So our bandwidth is provided by CashFly. The bass is by Vroom, recorded just for TMO. And that is all for this week. Peter, again, thank you very much.
Brian, thank you very much for having me. And thank you very much for listening.
And that's how you do it.
There you go.